If you are looking for even more help and guidance on your breakup, I have a few different options for you to take your healing to the next level. I have 4 different online courses depending on what stage of the breakup that you're in, from beginning all the way into moving on after heartbreak. Or you can bundle all of my courses together and use the code PODCAST to get $25 off my course bundle. I also have my 30-day no contact challenge to help hold you accountable in going no contact with your ex. And we have our free Facebook group, Healing Hearts Club, where you can connect with other people going through breakups all over the world. To learn more about any of these resources, head to the show notes where you can learn more about my courses, take the quiz to figure out which course is best for you, or join the Facebook group. And don't forget to use the code PODCAST to get $25 off my course bundle. Welcome to the Heal Your Heartbreak podcast with your host, Breakup Bestie, aka me, Kendra. Breakups are hard, but you don't have to do it alone. Each week, I will be taking you through a different topic as it relates to breaking up, healing from heartbreak, growing in your single life, dating, and getting back into happier and healthier relationships. The goal of this show is to provide support, hope, tips, and to remind you that above all, this too shall pass. Welcome back to another expert episode of the Heal Your Heartbreak podcast. Today, I am joined by Nicole Vignola. She is a neuroscientist, corporate consultant, author, speaker, who is committed to making neuroscience tangible for the masses. Her book, Rewire, The Neuroscience of a Good Life, is coming out in May. So definitely be on the lookout for that. And she is also a partner in an app called Reverie, which is an app that allows you to practice self-hypnosis. So I recorded this back in December and have been using the app and can say it has been so beneficial to me. So they have a grief section to help with things like a breakup. So we're talking today about neuroscience, self-hypnosis. I love learning about this aspect of breakups because I think it's so validating. And, you know, I've had people come on to talk about this stuff, but Nicole really gets into the details of it. What happens in your brain when you're in a relationship? What happens in your brain when you're going through a breakup? And one thing that I said to her at one point is like, it makes so much sense why so many people have the same universal experience when going through a breakup, because it's literally hardwired into our brain of things that why you go down memory lane constantly, why you feel this intense compulsion to look at your ex's social media or reach out to them. So I just love the way that Nicole makes this very approachable. She also talks about her own breakup that she went through, and I took so much from this. And I think, again, this is just very validating to know that it's not just you. It's something that is very physiological. So I know you guys are really going to enjoy this episode. As a quick side note, we did have a couple little connectivity issues during our interview. I was interviewing her she's in Portugal. So there's so much good content. But if you do hear a little bit of skipping with the audio, just know that there was a little bit of audio issue. But again, this episode is just so chock full of great information that we obviously had to put it out anyway. So I'm very happy to introduce you guys to Nicole Vignola. Welcome, Nicole, to the Heal Your Heartbreak podcast. It is so exciting to have you on to talk about this topic with you.
I'm so excited to be here. So thank you so much for asking me.
I would love to just start. I'm always just so curious as to how people got interested in the field that they're in. Can you kind of talk through what made you interested in the brain and how, you know, just everything that you're doing? I would love to hear kind of some background.
Yeah, I mean, I was always fascinated with kind of behavior, habits, kind of like the way that we integrate these habits and patterns. And, you know, I had a pretty difficult childhood, but I remember always kind of wondering why, not obviously there was elements of blame and, you know, pain, but there was this very pressing question of like needing to understand why it is that we behave in a particular way and how we are affected, you know, by particular things, you know, like we're going to be talking about breakups today, which is great. So just uncovering the kind of science and the mechanisms. I'm quite analytical. So understanding, you know, down to nanometer scale, what is going on in the brain on a neurobiological level, not just, you know, yeah.
That's great. And I think one thing that's been so interesting, and I'm sure, you know, people have been talking about it for a long time, but probably just recognized more widely, is that you can change your brain. I think, first of all, a lot of us haven't really spent much time thinking about our brains. And then to recognize that, okay, we do have this thing called neuroplasticity and we can change parts of the brain, which is so cool and fascinating and makes us feel less like we're, oh my gosh, I'm doomed, or
yeah,
I can't make changes because it feels like my brain's working against me.
Yeah, exactly. And that was actually a big part of my undergrad thesis was neuroplasticity. And that's what kind of got me into what I'm doing now, which is, you know, writing, I've just written my book, Rewire, which is all about, you know, how to implement these changes and how neuroplasticity can be applied to everyday life. So deeply fascinated by that as well.
Yeah. So for those who haven't heard the term, can you give us a little bit of background of what is neuroplasticity and what does it mean for us to be able to change our habits or change our outlook?
Yeah, absolutely. So neuroplasticity essentially means that we have the ability to reorganize our pathways in our brain, pathways of communication, so we can change habits and behaviors. So, you know, neurons normally fire in a particular sequence and they conduct messages to say that you should, you know, behave in a particular way or conduct a particular habit. And we actually have the ability to change those pathways, which is pretty remarkable because up until about the 60s, 70s, we were not very sure about that. And, you know, it's really interesting because sort of plasticians, so neuroscientists studying plasticity, were using the word plasticity, but in a roundabout way, because they didn't want to upset the scientists that were debunking the science. And it turned out that we can change, and up into adulthood as well, which is remarkable. So, you know, well into old age, we can still make plastic changes, you know, albeit harder, but not impossible.
Yeah. And I think it's very hopeful to know that there's not a, you know, I think as we get older, we like put our stake in the ground of I'm this sort of person or I'm this sort of person. And to know that there's a biological component of being able to change those things, we don't have to get stuck in that same kind of rut. Yeah. And, you know, we're obviously going to be talking about relationships. And I think that can happen a lot where people will say, oh, I'm this kind of person in a relationship. I choose these sorts of people in a relationship. Yeah. And just knowing that we can change that. Can you talk about first? I want to talk about for sure what happens in the brain during a breakup, but can you talk about what happens in the brain when we're in a relationship?
So do you mean when we're in love or?
Yeah, when we're in love. Yeah, like what's firing up there?
Yeah, I mean, a lot. And one of the interesting things is that we haven't fully understood what it is that makes us feel, you know, like everything, nothing else matters, right? And it's like almost an addiction in a way. So, you know, levels of oxytocin are really high. So oxytocin is pair bonding and neurotransmitter, kind of determines who's part of your in-group and who's part of your out-group. And that is extremely high. Things like dopamine, serotonin. So there's an element, you know, feeling great. Now that seems to appear and remain for the first 18 months, 2 years of the relationship. Those levels are heightened. Thereafter, they do tend to drop. And this is where scientists are kind of encouraging more of a partnership type look on the relationship. So even just understanding that these sort of neurotransmitters tend to diminish, relationship changes. And oftentimes people can see that or attribute that to a lack of spark or the relationship is kind of dying. But actually the relationship changes. And I think it's less driven by emotion and more driven by logic, which has its own pros and cons, of course. But, you know, the spark can kind of be reignited, if you will, through other means, like, you know, exploring things together, going on holiday regularly, and, you know, keeping things spicy, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I think that's good to know for people, like the 18 months to 2 years, that things can change. And I remember that in my relationship feeling like, oh, shoot. is this okay? Is this supposed to happen? You know, like, is this okay to be happening? I'm not feeling those same kind of like enthralled, addictive kind of feelings to my partner. I stopped wanting to always spend time with them and wanted to spend time with other people, which ultimately now looking back is very healthy to be able to do within a relationship. But when you go from that, I will literally go do anything with you to, no, I want my own space and I want, you know, my own life.
Yeah.
That can be very scary for someone that, you know, doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah. It's definitely a sense of safety and security, you know, and in those beginning times of the relationship, you're kind of testing whether you will get a reward. So, you know, you'll engage in particular behaviors that elicit a response where you're looking for validation. So if I, you know, do this, will they respond like this? And then, you know, after a year and a half or two, you sort of start to learn that you're safe with this person. You don't have to test those boundaries to see if you're in or you're out. And I think that there's something really powerful in that, because of course you can see it as, oh, well, you know, there's no more reward. And of course there isn't other ways, but I think that it gives us more of like, we know that it's an expected reward. So there's less dopamine because we know that we're safe in this relationship. So reframing that to see it as a positive, I think, and give us a lot of security.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And then on the flip side of that, if you do reach that place of feeling safe and kind of knowing what's going to happen, and then you're broken up with, that I'm sure like throws the whole system into overdrive.
Yeah. Yes. And there's another aspect to that. A lot of people think that, you know, they need to find rewards elsewhere, you know, and this is where kind of infidelity can come into play, because there's that dopamine's kind of lowered. So there's that aspect. And then there's the aspect of obviously being broken up with, and that, you know, brings its own, you know, realm of pain. And it's interesting because when we look at pain in the brain, or sort of emotional pain and physical pain, it's been attributed to very similar kinds of pain. So, you know, it can even be as painful, a breakup can be as painful as breaking a bone. Now, I've never broken a bone, so I don't know how painful that is, but I have been dumped and that is, you know, pretty horrific. So
yeah,
I don't want to go through either.
Well, that's really, and I mean, again, I think I was talking to you before we started, but I think the biggest thing that I've learned in talking to people who do talk about more of the physiological aspect of going through heartbreak, it is very validating for people to hear like, okay, your brain is feeling similar pain to actually breaking a bone. Because I think one of the things we do during a breakup is try to minimize it or judge ourselves for quote unquote overreacting to the situation. Yeah. When in reality, your body is, you know, your body is registering what's happening. So what is happening when, you know, so you're getting pumped full of all the things in a relationship, and then all of a sudden that's gone. What happens at that point?
Just to backtrack a tiny bit. Yeah. So when we have pain in our body, especially something like a breakup, grief, or breaking a bone, there's an area of the brain called the periaqueductal brain, which is essentially responsible for dampening pain signals. Now, norepinephrine is also responsible for alertness and kind of not motivation as such, but it can fall under the realms of stress as well. So that's one of the reasons why you kind of feel tired and exhausted by pain sometimes as well, which is really interesting, because a lot of people tend to have, you know, problems sleeping. That's obviously got to do with a plethora of mechanisms, not just this one, but one of those is the fact that norepinephrine is heightened. So you're in a state of alertness, hypervigilance, you know, constantly checking your surroundings and grieving, right? And that's a really interesting thing for me, because I think a lot of people don't realize the impact that just dampening that pain that you're going through has on you. So knowing these things gives us so much power in knowing how to navigate this a little bit more smoothly. But, you know, back to your second point, we've had this sort of constant supply of dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, all these kind of feel-good neurochemicals, endorphins as well. And when we're, you know, cut off from that supply, you don't have that regular kind of income, if you will, of neurotransmitters. So the body goes into quite literally a withdrawal. And we've looked at this in fMRI studies. So fMRIs basically look at activity in the brain. And we've seen that areas like the ventral tegmental area, which is responsible for motivation and, you know, drive to gain that motivation, are increased. And then areas like the nucleus accumbens, which is responsible for craving and pleasure, are also heightened. So we have the tendency to want to either text our ex or find out what they're doing or hear by the grapevine if they have a new person in their lives, or, you know, maybe we're texting other people on, so, you know, on dating websites, and because that gives a sense of reward. So we're getting that dopamine from other ways, but they're not really sustainable and healthy ways. I put that in, I don't know if this is being recorded in terms of video, but I'm putting that in inverted commas for anyone that's listening, which, you know, can kind of drive us a little bit crazy, like an addiction, quite literally. So there's that aspect of that. And then obviously, you know, serotonin, oxytocin, all those kind of feel, like oxytocin, serotonin kind of make you feel good, warm and comfortable, safe and happy. And when that supply is being cut off, there's, you know, elements of sleep deprivation, irritability, of course, mood swings, severe mood swings as well, where you kind of swing from one extreme to another. And, you know, understanding that the brain has its own self-regulatory process, you know, the brain's basically concerned with reaching homeostasis. So how can it replenish these neurotransmitters and get to a point where it's doing that again without this external input of a relationship? Now, we can do that in other ways, like healthier ways. And I, again, put that in inverted commas because everybody's kind of idea of that is different. But, you know, things like exercise, things like, you know, connecting with friends and loved ones. And again, these connections need to be meaningful and valuable, because that's what's going to really release oxytocin. So people always say that oxytocin is released when you're having a conversation with people, but that's not actually true. It needs to be a very kind of like deep, meaningful conversation, quite literally, you know, that warm feeling you get when you just had a conversation with your friend. You're like, oh my word, I feel amazing.
Yeah.
That's oxytocin.
Okay. That's really good to know. It's also really interesting that the brain wants to reach that point on its own. But it's also interesting. I mean, I hope people listening to this are like, oh, this makes a lot of sense as to why the mood swings, the high motivation to like reach out to your ex. I get that all the time of people. I don't understand it. I felt like I was a very even keeled person before this. Like, I wasn't someone that checked my ex's phone or anything like that. And then all of a sudden, it's like, I mean, I don't like to use the word crazy, but people will say like, I feel like a crazy person after this breakup and it doesn't feel like me.
And that's also because executive control is essentially being overridden by these limbic areas, like the ones I just mentioned, the nucleus accumbens, ventral tegmental area. They're responsible for getting what it wants. You know, people who have addictions have severe dysfunctions in these areas. And that is why someone who doesn't have an addiction will think, well, it's just easy. Don't call your dealer. Don't go for a drink. But it's not that simple. You know, executive control is being quite literally overridden. So decision-making logical centers are no longer active. And that's what's really, in some ways, scary, but also gives us the sense of autonomy in knowing how to deal with these situations. Because now, yeah, like you said, I know you don't like to use the word crazy, and I agree, but it does. It feels like you're a bit crazy. And it's quite normal. I'd love to meet someone who hasn't checked up on their ex or tried to find out something about them. I definitely want to speak to anyone who's ever not done that, because I find that really remarkable. But, and I think it's completely normal, but there's an element of needing to be really strict in that and kind of going cold turkey, right? If you want to, you're going to rip off the band-aid. And, you know, it's because this, the other component to this is that through neuroplasticity, which can work in our favor, but also against us, we end up becoming sort of in a habit and a pattern of checking up on these people. And it's interesting because I have some friends, and I've definitely done this before, who check up on their exes, ex-girlfriends who aren't even girlfriends with the guys anymore. So it's just, they're in such a habit of checking up on this person because they've now seen it as like entertainment and just a habitual response that they enact on a daily basis, which, you know, is also kind of a slippery slope. So
yeah. I mean, I hear the word compulsion a lot when people will say, because I always am promoting going cold turkey with that kind of stuff, because I have reached that point where it does feel like every time I open my phone or every time I'm on social media, it's like I go straight to checking that, because it's weird, because it's to check up on your ex is painful, but it also does scratch an itch that kind of feels good at the same time. It's, I don't know, it's, if you're trying to explain it, it does not make sense, but I think people listening will understand the fact of like, it does feel good, even though it hurts.
Yeah. Well, so we have something called reward prediction error. And when we basically are expecting a reward, our dopamine increases in anticipation of getting that reward. We know that the reward's going to be there, so it rises before. But if we don't know that the reward is going to be there, it actually spikes when we receive the reward. And that is what's happening when you're going on social media, because there's an element of you obviously expecting a reward, but you don't know what it's going to be. So let me just explain this in terms of like maybe example. So if you're working on something like a goal, your dopamine will be high in pursuit of reaching that goal. Once you reach that goal, you've handed in your thesis, you've finished your book, there's normally a drop in dopamine. And that's in its own way the reason why people sometimes get up, like they kind of see that as a they need another mountain, they need another goal. They don't see happiness within that. They get a sense of not being fulfilled. But then when you don't expect a reward and you get it unexpectedly, that's when dopamine hits. And that's what's happening when we're on social media. As I said, there's an element of you looking for a reward, but you don't know what it's going to be. So it makes us feel really good. And that's that itch that you've just scratched. You're like, oh, dopamine. I just saw what I wanted to see or potentially wanted to see because you don't know what you're going to see, but you're hoping you're going to see something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that completely makes sense. And I think I've never even made that connection that, I mean, obviously people do it because if there's something they're getting from it. If it was just misery every time you looked at your ex's social media, I wouldn't need to encourage people not to look, but obviously you're getting something from it and that's what's causing you to keep looking. I would love to hear, so as someone who is obviously very aware of what's happening in your brain and stuff, how did that look when you went through a breakup? I don't know how recent your breakup was, but I know you had gone through one. What is it like to have awareness of what's going on?
Well, I didn't have this awareness at
Okay.
the
Okay.
time. So unfortunately,
Okay.
I wish I'd known when I had my own book to read because, so I was dating a cocaine addict, and when I moved to Bristol to study neuroscience, he was supposed to come with me, and 3 days into going there, he dumped me over the phone, and we'd been together for 3 years, so it was, quite a shock to be, broken up with via the phone after, such a long time. And obviously being in a new city, no friends, university, I was a mature student. I went to university at the age of 26. So there was a lot there. And I didn't really know how to navigate it at the time, but it forced me into kind of spending time alone. And I think that's what I can really take away from that, because I learned a lot about myself. And it's interesting because when he came back sort of a few years later to do his amendments as part of his 12-step program, he asked me, like, is there anything you want to clear up? Or like, what kind of questions can I answer? And it was interesting because by the time we'd had that conversation, I was actually okay with everything by then. And I wish he'd asked me maybe a year before, because then I would have been like, okay, let me just get the scroll
Yeah.
out.
I've
How much?
actually been keeping a list, so
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'm just going to whip out my journal.
yeah.
And I realized, my part in it, my part in allowing a lot of those kind of behaviors, and the kind of how low my self-esteem was to be able to allow those things to happen in the relationship and let them slide. And that's one of the really interesting things about sort of toxic relationships, is it's something called, it's loosely sort of termed in the literature, but we call it creep normality. And that is essentially you change your perception of what normal is because you start accepting a new normal. So over time, you change what, your life is supposed to look like because you're willing to accept new things. And I think that's the most interesting phenomenons of toxic relationships or abusive relationships, because you start to kind of shift that narrative to suit what you kind of want in that moment in time. Because sometimes it's harder to take that step into change than to just accept what you've got right now. And I think that was a huge, huge realization for me that I'd, essentially changed my normal.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It is so important to share your thoughts and feelings while going through a breakup, especially if it's something you're feeling any guilt or shame around. I know whenever I'm struggling with a certain thought or situation and I keep it to myself, it gets heavier and heavier and feels harder and harder to manage. I truly believe we are as sick as our secrets. Therapy has always been a safe space for me to have a judgment-free zone to get things off my chest. Whether it's something from my past, a current struggle, or something I'm anxious about in the future, I always feel lighter when I'm able to share something that feels feel scary. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/heartbreak today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/heartbreak. The last time I went through a breakup, I know my mom was someone I was really able to lean on and get support from. She has always been a rock for me through heartbreak and everything in between. And with Mother's Day right around the corner, I wanted to share an idea of something super special that you can gift to your mom. MyLifeInABook.com is a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Every week, they will email your mom a question, and she can either type out an answer or record one. And at the end, MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book, and they can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. I gifted my mom this, and it means so much to me that I can not only learn so many of her stories, but also preserve them for my kids and future generations. My mom has already talked about how fun it's been for her to reflect on her past and think about things that she hasn't in so long. It even prompted her to dig up some old photos from when she was in the newspaper for being the only female mail carrier in Detroit in the 60s. So cool. Check out mylifeinabook.com and use code HEARTBREAK at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com. Use code HEARTBREAK for 10% off today.
Yeah. And then it, what's crazy too, is then normal, like, I don't know what normal is, but more of a normal, healthy relationship feels like it's missing something or feels strange. And, you know, talking to people who have come out of toxic relationships, which, you know, I've had my one toxic relationship, I hear like, I feel bored, or I don't feel like I'm attracted to someone who is healthy, yeah, balanced, not an addict, you know, things like that.
There's an element of that, of course. And I don't think I had to work through that. I felt like I had gone through enough that I was like, I never want that again.
Yeah.
I can 100% see how that happens. And I'm actually working with a client on that because, yeah, he's having to kind of recalibrate what normal is again. We need to kind of recalibrate that normal, because people will get stuck in these narratives that say, oh, this is my type. This is what I like. I like whirlwind relationships. But a lot of it is, you know, maybe genetic preferences, but it could also be that narrative that you've attached and that mindset that keeps you stuck in some ways wanting this whirlwind relationship. And one of the great things, I know we haven't quite gotten to self-hypnosis yet,
yeah,
self-hypnosis really helps you to envision a different set of sort of things that you want for yourself, essentially. So it helps you to visualize things differently. And, you know, a lot of people don't know how to feel comfortable in that boredom or that safety, because it's something that they've never really known. And that was me for a long time. You know, I grew up in a very turbulent household. So for me, dating a cocaine addict was like, woohoo, we feel at home here.
I'm home.
Yeah,
even like being home for the holidays. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, this is where I belong. Because, you know, that, you know, addiction's in my family. So I was repeating patterns, right, that I was observing from my peers. And so, you know, as I said, I didn't really have to reassess that normal, but I did also go to therapy, which helped me kind of see things from that perspective. But I can see how people do that. And I definitely have friends that tend to repeat these patterns because they don't want that boring guy or that boring girl. But really, you can get also those, just because they're not toxic doesn't mean they don't have to be fun in other ways. But, you know, recalibrating where we want our safety to be is important. And that's where self-hypnosis can really help you, because it can help you kind of dissociate. And I mean that in a positive way, because I know the word dissociation is often attributed to sort of negative connotations like survival mechanisms, but we have an ability to observe our thoughts. And it's interesting, you said that earlier, you were saying that you never really think about your brain or your thoughts, or you said something like that. But we have the ability to do that. It's called metacognition, which is really, really interesting. It's our ability to think about our thoughts whilst observing them, whilst also thinking them at the same time. It's a really weird phenomenon. We're the only species that can do that, as far as I know. That may have changed since I looked at the literature. But why that's interesting is because we can actually change perception of where we want to be and then work towards that, you know? So kind of like baby steps, bringing ourselves out of this new comfort zone or this new normal into something that is, you know, something else, but is not necessarily unsafe.
Got it. Yes. No, that makes complete sense. And just going back to what you said about kind of the recalibration. So I've been in recovery for like 11 years. I went to a treatment program almost 11 years ago. And I remember they showed us a video basically showing that for people who have addictions, the level of which they need like stimulation or pleasure starts getting so high when you're in an addiction, and you have to take the time to lower that threshold. Otherwise, you're not going to get joy out of like
everyday,
we'll say like the simple things, the everyday things. But what's so interesting is that does happen, you know, and we can change. You got so much joy out of having someone in your life that you were addicted to and had that relationship with. It doesn't mean you need to replace them with someone else like that. It just might mean you need that time alone to bring that kind of level down. So I hadn't thought about that in a really long time, but that just made me think of that.
Yeah. And that was perfect, because that's exactly what's happening is we, again, going back to thinking that we are wired this way, but actually it's a neurobiological mechanism that maybe just needs to be recalibrated and changed, and it needs to reach homeostasis so that you're not seeking these kind of volatile thresholds anymore.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about, so you mentioned that's like something you're very much an expert in, is this idea of self-hypnosis. Can you talk a little bit about that, what that is? Because I think a lot of people think of hypnosis as like a show that they watch where they like someone has to like act like a chicken or something out of their own free will. So can you talk about hypnosis and self-hypnosis in the way that it can be really helpful?
Yeah. And it's one of the things that Dr. David Spiegel is really trying to sort of break, is that stigma around stage hypnosis, because it's not really how it works. And I actually just recently watched a film on Netflix. I can't remember what it's called, and I don't want to promote it anyway, but it was awful. And they were kind of showing this woman, like listening to the psychiatrist make her do things. And I was like, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
So it's a real shame that we have that stigma, but because, you know, self-hypnosis, or really all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. So it's the ability to enter a focused state of attention. So you know how when you're in the cinema, you are watching the film and everything else kind of falls away and you forget about your life's problems. You're completely absorbed in this film. And when you come out, you're kind of like, whoa, I forgot that the world kind of existed outside of this void. And that's essentially what self-hypnosis is. So you have a salience network that is responsible for detecting, you know, salient stimuli. So sounds, right now you're listening to me, but if there was like maybe a dog barking outside, your attention will be shifted to that and then it will come back to me. So what self-hypnosis does is it lowers the activity in the salience network so that you can completely become absorbed in your own internal state. So your focused state of attention. That's when you then become in a state of kind of suggestibility. Now, again, that word, you know, people can kind of get a bit shaky when they hear it. And it doesn't mean that you're going to start dancing around like a chicken, but it puts you in a place of being able to more malleable, right? You can now start making these plastic changes in the space because, you know, the outside world is blocked out and you can focus on the task at hand. And that's the difference between self-hypnosis and meditation. Is self-hypnosis is more of like a goal-directed activity. Meditation is great in its own ways, but it has different benefits. Whereas self-hypnosis is more like, think of a goal that you want to work, a habit or a behavior that you're trying to change. Self-hypnosis is going to be the quickest way to get you there.
Okay. I've had a few friends that have gone through like hypnotic therapy, and I reached what I wanted to reach in a matter of sessions, what I've been trying to get through with a therapist for like 5 years. Like, I have heard such great benefits from this sort of thing. Can you give an example of, like, let's get specific with a breakup. What's a kind of shift or thing that you might work on if you are going through a breakup?
There's a couple of things. So when we're going through a breakup, we've seen through fMRI studies again, that areas of the brain responsible for autobiographical memories are heightened. So that's why you start kind of going down memory lane, reminiscing on old times. And it's kind of a biased view on things as well, because you only remember the good times. This is why, you know, with clients, I always get them to write a list of all the things that they actually don't like about this person, or the kind of more factual aspects of the relationship, because especially when we're in an emotional state, the limbic system overrides the logical centers. So you're more likely to believe this kind of memory lane, and you're more likely to go into a ruminative state where you start yourself and those autobiographical memories of yourself and you know, negative self-referential information starts becoming heightened. And one of the interesting things about self-hypnosis is that it actually turns down activity in the default mode network. So the default mode network is a network of brain areas that are responsible for your internal thoughts about yourself and future planning, thinking about your friends, thinking about your family. And that's where rumination tends to occur. This is, you know, this is grounded in 10 years of clinical data, 45 years of data that Dr. Spiegel has been doing. But the last 10 years, he's been looking at these networks specifically. And they've seen that the default mode network activity is lowered in individuals that both meditate and do self-hypnosis. But with self-hypnosis, there are other things that are going on, which I'll explain, that help you just get to that point a little bit quicker. Now, so when you take things like benzodiazepines, they work on GABA receptors. So you're essentially increasing your own internal supply of benzodiazepines in some ways. So it's an anxiolytic therapeutic response, essentially, which can help you lower those feelings of anxiety so that you can see the problem. So, you know, you're maybe revisiting these issues, but without that sort of anxious response that's being attached to it. Because when we have an overactive amygdala, and this is also what happens during breakups, is that that amygdala becomes hyperactive. So you're more prone to hypervigilance, detecting threats in your environment. You're on edge, you're worrying about, you know, what your ex might have thought, what his friends are saying about you now, what, you know, so many layers to this. But that sort of self-hypnosis helps increase GABA in the limbic system, which can give you that anxiolytic sort of, or kind of relief that makes you just, yeah.
I mean, I think that's really interesting. And there's been so many things that you have just said, like the autobiographical kind of thing. It makes sense to me why I've learned over the years that like so many people have almost the exact universal experience when going through a breakup. And it makes sense because it's literally hardwired into our bodies and our brains. Yeah. So why we start going down memory lane and remembering the good parts and why we do feel, because the only times I've like had actual panic attacks have been shortly after a breakup where it was like, I felt like I could not gain control. I felt like there was no sense of safety, no sense of like relief from the anxiety that was coming.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that. I actually wrote about it in my book and it's called Broken Heart Syndrome. And essentially I had a kind of in inverted commas heart attack in the lab in my neuroscience undergraduate right after the breakup. And I thought I was having a heart attack. It wasn't a panic attack, but when I went to go and see the doctor, they said that I was suffering from something called broken heart syndrome, which is essentially a temporary weakening of the heart wall. So my body, a heart attack in many ways, obviously not as severe because there's still function there. There's still blood being pumped through the body, but the feeling is very similar. So it's interesting you say that because a lot of people do suffer with either, you know, broken heart syndrome. There's an overlap with panic attacks because you know, your brain is hyperactive to everything. So yeah, I hope that people find solace in hearing this and kind of going, oh my gosh, it's not just me. Oh my gosh, I'm normal. I'm not crazy. I'm allowed to feel these things. You absolutely should. And it's one of the things I've written in my book that, like, you know, we are human after all. It's both a beauty and a conundrum at the same time that we have the ability to feel the way that we do. So in some ways we need to honor those feelings, you know, whilst also working through them, but not always trying to dampen them away by pushing them out, you know, maybe dealing with them through more healthy mechanisms, like, you know, I said about dopamine, finding easier kind of outlets of dopamine. So, you know, maybe going to work out, and again, the social connection that I was talking about, you know, things like self-hypnosis. So we have, you know, anxiolytic relief from the anxiety that we're feeling in our bodies. And one of the other interesting things that happens during hypnosis is that we actually have a heightened functional connectivity between the dorsal prefrontal cortex also lateral prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for executive function, so executive control, and the insula. So the insula is responsible for detecting kind of internal salient stimuli. So, you know, how you're feeling inside, anxious, stressed, but we are able to sort of have a top-down regulation in response to that. So what I mean by that is you're still able to logically assess what is going on whilst also feeling all these things. And that's the wonderful thing about self-hypnosis. So you know you're anxious, you know you're stressed, but you still have this kind of top-down regulation where you can reason with yourself and walk through this feeling and this pain.
Well, that, I mean, and you were talking about this earlier, how our executive function does kind of go offline when we're going through a breakup. And there is, as much as, you know, we want to really work through the raw emotions of things, there is something that makes it so feel so much more manageable when we can have like, okay, I'm feeling anxious. That's totally okay. This is temporary. This is going to pass, instead of being lost in that phase of like, I'm never going to feel better again. I'm never going to find love again. We get very, again, we need better words for like crazy dramatic, but we get very dramatic in our feelings of like, this is never going to change. I'm going to feel like this forever. Like this like permanent kind of scary feeling that comes with it.
Yeah. In psychology, we call it catastrophize, if that helps for a better term. So
yes, that's a better term.
Yes, it is. I'm okay with those terms because I do think that we feel them. So hearing someone else saying that that's also how they feel, I think gives us a sense of sort of solace in knowing that we're not the only ones. But yeah, catastrophize is a very common theme in breakups, you know, never finding someone else again. But we also have to remember that the state we're in is highly emotional and our rational thoughts are diminished. So any kind of conclusions that we come to in the state should probably not be adhered to for the rest of eternity, right? We're not always going to feel like this.
I did want to kind of get a little bit more practical in this, in the self-hypnosis. So how can people be able to start implementing that? So I know in your book, you talk about it. You're part of the Reverie team that is an app, right? And I would love if you could give some background on that, that can help it. But I would love if people could walk away with, you know, maybe one thing that they can start doing.
Yeah. So Reverie is actually just, well, firstly, let me backtrack. Reverie is an app that is grounded in 45 years of clinical data from Dr. David Spiegel, who's the chair of psychiatry at Stanford Medicine. So, you know, he rolled out an app, which is amazing to be able to bring this to the masses. And it's, they've just rolled out a grief and heartbreak or manage your grief and heartbreak activity on there. And 85% of users are reporting relief already and improvement, which is great that we can even track these things. So I actually started using Reverie way before I became a partner in the company. But so when they reached out to me, I was like, oh my gosh, they've been such an integral part of my journey. So I got to meet Dr. Spiegel via Zoom, which was pretty wild for me because I could hear his voice, which had been guiding me through self-hypnosis for years. So I was a bit like, wow, you're actually asking me questions. That voice had been so sort of familiar to me, yet I'd never met him. So I had a real mind-blowing moment in that time, I must say. So, you know, Self-Reverie is an app that has self-hypnosis activities on there. There's a plethora of activities. There's focus, there's sleep, there's fear of flying, there's, you know, change of habit, eating habits, the way that you see food. And, you know, more recently, the grief one, which has been sort of one of our best ones so far. And you can practice this on a daily basis. And it essentially helps you reassess where you want to be, how you can get over this breakup. And again, give you a sense of autonomy and control. Because, you know, we've already said that we feel kind of like we're catastrophizing, we're out of control, the emotional brain is overriding us. But through self-hypnosis, we get that anxiolytic relief that I already spoke about. We can get that executive control back online and lower that default mode network activity, which is responsible for ruminating thoughts that keep us wondering at night whether we said the wrong thing or whether we should have done things differently. So, and that can become a sort of self-deprecating kind of loop where if we don't address it, it becomes a habit. And yeah, that's Reverie.
I love that. I'm going to download it for sure. I think, can it also help with, so going back to kind of what we were talking about in the beginning, there's obviously a lot of habits that come just with a relationship. You know, you call them when you're on your way home from work, like all those things. So I think there are those habits that we can pick up in the breakup, like checking social media, self-deprecating thoughts, the could haves, the should haves. But I think there's also something to be said about also needing to kind of rewire the habits that we picked up from the relationship. So do you feel like this could also help with that?
Yeah. And I'm so glad you said that, because I've been wanting to throw that in the whole time and I just haven't really found the moment to talk about it. But that's the opening chapter to the grief section in my book, where I talk about, you know, this person has been ingrained in your neuronal network, in the way that your brain fires. So like you said, you get out of work and you think, I'm just going to call them. And you go, oh gosh, no, I can't. And, you know, you wake up in the morning and there's so many, you know, conscious things that are happening, but also subconscious, you know, in the way that you may be operating, you know, nuanced perspectives that we can't really, you know, can't find an example right now. So there's a lot going on where your brain is having to readjust and recalibrate to the fact that this person is not there in your life anymore on so many levels. So, you know, and I love that you said this, so we can recalibrate those habits, those beliefs as well, about how we see ourselves and how we speak to ourselves. And of course, you know, the habits that we have ingrained with being with that person too. And as I said, self-hypnosis helps you just kind of visualize what it's going to be in that new space so that you can slowly walk towards it.
I mean, it's so interesting because I always say that, like, there's so many little habits that we have to break as we're navigating a breakup. Just the way we think, it's like, when you're in a relationship and you're picturing, what am I going to do over summer holiday? And it's like, oh, I'm obviously going to take a trip with my partner. And so you have to start being like, but it is, it makes sense why we're so exhausted too, because you have to think of, like, you can't really be on autopilot during a breakup. You you have to really like white knuckle your way through it, because you're doing everything so differently.
Exactly. And that's the other component to that, because, you know, a lot of our behaviors and habits are sort of running on automaticity. So we arrive at conclusions through mental heuristics, which are shortcuts that your brain takes. But now it's having to pay attention and really think about doing things differently, which requires a lot of cognitive energy to make these changes, because until they're habitual and ingrained, it's going to require a lot of energy from you. And that's one of the reasons why we can feel so emotionally, mentally, and physically exhausted going through a breakup. So, you know, I think the biggest take-home message is that I hope that people get to see that, you know, what happens to us when we're going through a breakup, and why we just need to kind of really nurture ourselves through this time and get through it, rather than kind of like, you know, of course there's an element of needing to change, but trying to change things and push things away and think that there's something wrong with you because you're going through this, whilst I encourage people to see it as a time to facilitate the change and the grief. Kind of like putting your arms around and saying, okay, this is what we're going through, but it will change. Brain can change. We can change. We can recalibrate. You know, self-hypnosis is there to help us through this process. And we're just going to let time also take its course, because, you know, that's one thing we can't fight against is time.
That's such a great message. And I think a perfect place to end on, because we don't want to fight it. And I think hopefully hearing how deeply ingrained the things are that are happening to us are happening, it's not a matter of you just not having good control over your emotions. It's literally something that, like, it's chemicals, it's things that in some ways are out of your control, but also are in your control. So that's the positive of it. But can you talk about your book and where people can find you? Is the book out yet?
Book is coming out in May 24 in the UK and the 4th in the US. So
perfect.
It's a pretty big deal. I've already got 15 translations. So
amazing.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal. It's a great, I'm so proud of it. I think it's the first time in my life where I'm like, I'm really proud of this. I mean, I've handed in theses and my life and research projects, and I'm always like, this will do. Whereas this one, I'm like, I've poured my heart and soul into it. And I think, you know, working with Reverie, it's just, we're so aligned with our beliefs and how we want to make these changes. So I hope that it will really help people understand what is going on, so that they can stop kind of blaming themselves.
So I assume we can download Reverie in like wherever app store kind of thing.
Exactly. And actually, Reverie's having a 30% sale for this December.
Okay, perfect.
Definitely try and get that now. Daily membership. The book is coming out in May. It's called Rewire. And you can find me on Nicole's Neuroscience on Instagram. I'm only on Instagram.
Perfect. And I'll link everything in the show notes. But thank you so much, Nicole, for coming on and sharing this. It's so fascinating. And I just love to be able to keep learning about what's going on when we're going through breakups.
I love talking talking about this. So I love empowering people and knowing that, you know, there's hope.
Yeah, I love that. Well, we will keep an eye out for your book and hopefully I'll jump on Reverie. And yeah, thanks again.
I hope you enjoyed today's show. If you loved it, I hope you'll leave a review and share with your friends. If you're not already following me on Instagram, head to @yourbreakupbestie, where I'm sharing new content almost every day. To join our Facebook group, Healing Hearts Club, where you can connect with thousands of people from all over the world going through breakups, head to the link in the show notes. And don't forget to check out my online courses for more in-depth help through your healing journey. I always end these episodes the same way, reminding you to be nice to yourself, stay connected with loved ones, and the biggest reminder is that this too shall pass. I promise.